no chair for this panel, so each of us will introduce ourselves and we will go in the order listed in the program.
Well, I guess I'm listed first, so I will begin. I'm Lou Mensch, Mensch auf Deutsch. It was a surprise that three of us went to German-speaking missions, we discovered, and two of us to the same mission. Mönch actually means monk in German, and I figured that I was named after an ancestor who must have been a black sheep to have had any progeny. But, I spent my time in the Central German Mission from 1962 to 1965. I received my conception of what a mission was like, I guess from the same source where I received my sex education, which was from neighbor kids and from some psychiatric texts in my father's bedroom library. The neighbor kids were the progeny of Wallace Taranto, who was at that time the recently returned and certainly not yet released president of the 1950s Czechoslovakian mission. And what his kids told me was that on missions, when there were cottage meetings, you went up into the attic and you looked down from the ceiling onto the saints gathered in the living room down below, including the two men in the dark suits, who in this case were not elders but were agents. And these two men may very likely take your father away and you wouldn't see him again for a long period of time. So I knew that a mission carried some intrigue with it. The second source was my father's bookshelf. There were fascinating case histories in the textbooks, not of missionaries, but of mentally ill people. And tucked between the pages of one of these books, I think it was Freud's Future of an Illusion, which talks about religion as neurosis, were some notes talking about religion as psychosis. These were notes from the department chairman of psychiatry at the University of Utah at the time, Hardin Branch, who had come up with the startling conclusion in one of his discussions that my father apparently had attended, that based on the admissions to the university hospital, and I think too at that time the LDS hospital, the percentage or the incidence of schizophrenia among LDS missionaries was 80 times the national average. So I knew that a mission drove you insane. And those two things being quite appealing to me, I always wanted to go on a mission. I also knew I always wanted to be a physician, and there was some conflict there. Neither of these actually was my fatherly expectation, but when my father knew that I did want to go to medical school, he was not really excited for me to go on a mission. He had spent a long time plowing through undergraduate and medical school under real hardship conditions himself, and he knew that it was a long and a strenuous ordeal. And I had happened to have a scholarship to a very fine university and also a spot on the athletic roster, and they weren't going to wait 2.5 years and save that scholarship for me. But I wanted to go nevertheless, and therefore stayed instead at the University of Utah and went on the mission after 1 year. First thing I'd have done differently then would have been to accept that scholarship and continue and complete my undergraduate studies, get a bachelor's degree before I went. I was very envious of a companion in the mission home who had just graduated from Harvard and seemed to me as somebody who had had life revealed to him in the process. I was amazed by another missionary there who had gone through undergraduate and medical school, his internship, and a surgical residency, and then decided to go on a mission, and interestingly enough, later became my stake president. Well, most missionaries are much younger. They are struggling to bring adolescence to a closure, and I think they make missionaries who are not nearly as effective as these more mature, older, better educated people would. In fact, I'm reminded of the comment of a professor of pediatrics who reminded us that adolescence is really psychopathic dwarfism with good prognosis. The next thing I would change is my farewell service. Mine was 2.5 hours long, including a half-hour speech from myself. And I had just finished 5 days in the mission home in Salt Lake. That was the MTC of those days. It was a much abbreviated experience, but I loved almost every minute of it. And I guess I thought I was giving a homecoming speech when I went to my farewell after those 5 days. I later learned that to be considered a successful missionary, it was not necessary to have tracked it at all, to have learned any of the discussions, borne testimony, or obeyed any mission rules. What was really necessary was to come home and give a whiz-bang kind of homecoming talk, and nobody would ever know anything that went on for those 2 years, other than that you certainly were a spiritual and an excellent elder. Well, I say that almost everything in the mission home experience impressed me. All the way from messages and testimonies of general authorities to the mission matron's explanation of how to fold up a suit coat and put it in your suitcase, minimizing the wrinkles. She taught us some other things. She admonished us to wash our socks after every wearing, for example, and I always wished one of my companions had heeded her advice. In trying to save money, he wore his for 7 days before taking them off, and he had discovered a way to prevent odor by not rinsing the soap out after he did wash them eventually. And that seemed to work quite well, but it created some interesting effects on rainy days, which were most of them, when his feet began to bubble and foam. She talked of dressing conservatively as well, and that was fine advice, although it was ignored by several of the missionaries trying to comply with the mission rules that said you will wear hats from October to March. I could never figure out the purpose of those rules, but they were there. And so the missionaries all made a dutiful stop for the first time in their lives to the haberdashery. And sometimes with what they came out with, you couldn't tell if this was a major lapse in judgment or a cry for help. Two mission home experiences unsettled me quite a bit. Speaking of testimonies of the general authorities, I love to hear such people as Marion Hanks, because he would always tell a story of compassion rather than dogma. Only later, after I'd already arrived in the mission field, did I learn about a testimony I missed. We used to always go over to the Hotel Utah basement to eat, and there was a certain black waiter there who, at the end of each term, used to bear his testimony impromptu to all of the missionaries. And then the next day, the missionaries would have their testimony meeting just before departing out for their various fields, and inevitably, missionaries would get up and say, of all the things I've heard this week, I was not impressed more by anybody than by the testimony of this black waiter. And that seemed to embarrass some people who felt that he was usurping their turf or something, and they asked him to quit bearing his testimony after that. One other experience back in those days was my first experience with the temple endowment. I made an earnest effort to create a real spiritual mindset that was thwarted by an elder next to me who kept whispering, boy, this is really weird. What's going on here? And much later, when I learned how to question, I found myself asking the same question. So if I were going to go on a mission again, I hope I would go through the temple, through the endowment ceremony, with two major changes. In fact, there have been two major changes since then, fortunately the last one in 1990. And I wouldn't have to worry about penalties, and I wouldn't have to worry about skin color. I would hope, and this is yet to come, I would hope to hear the word love in that ordinance, and I would hope to learn something about the true order of prayer. Well, thinking about this distracting elder and thinking about Dr. Branch's statistics on schizophrenia raises a question for me. If I were to go on a mission again, should I really go? Or who should really go? Certainly, mission calls have been arranged as penance and reform for many young people showing signs of dereliction, and as treatment for many who can't quite finish school or hold a job or sustain a relationship. It's hard for me to imagine a more difficult task than to be a mission president, providing leadership and emotional support and spiritual guidance and the practicalities of pairings and transfers and motivating programs for a group of, say, 150 elders and sisters, one or two of whom will be schizophrenic. Same number will be manic depressive. About 22 of them will be unipolar depressed. 12 will have anxiety or panic disorders. 4 will be severe obsessive compulsives, and a few will have scrupulosity syndrome or assorted personality disorders. And half a dozen will be actively homosexual. Most of the elders and some of the sisters, in fact, will be hormones on feet. Well, I recall as a psychiatric resident in Philadelphia long after my mission, consulting with Elder Pinnock, who at that time was the president of the Pennsylvania mission, about various mission problems and problem missionaries, and asked me, for example, one time, what do I do with this new elder who was a grandson of a general authority who was sent out with instructions to Elder Pinnock to reform him. He was arrogant, he was defiant, and he was gay, and his last homosexual contact had been when he sneaked out of the mission training school the week before. Well, there has been the dilemma often of what I should do as a psychiatrist with missionaries who have come to me, or prospective missionaries who have had various problems of this sort. Somebody who is very depressed, for example, who has very low self-esteem and wants to go on a mission. Should I approve his going? Well, the risk, of course, is that he'll struggle and he'll fail and he'll drag down his companion's morale and he'll feel even worse when he has to come home again. Should I tell him he's not mission material and further undermine his self-esteem? Or should I let him go so that he won't have to face the stigma of his ward, who asked why isn't he going on a mission and it must be a lapse in faith or morality or something? And I'm not going to answer that question, but leave it for discussion time about who should and who shouldn't go on a mission. Do we send some people who shouldn't go at all? The same question, I think, could be asked further when we look at the church's primary mission. You know, we've learned about the three prongs, to proclaim the gospel, to perfect the saints, and to redeem the dead. If we are to proclaim the gospel, then who should proclaim it? Are the Doctrine and Covenants guidelines sufficient, or should we also use a sociology textbook and perhaps the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders in deciding this? The mission statement also raises the question, whom should I teach? Well, ideally, the honest in heart, whatever that means. It's easy for me to confuse the honest in heart with people very receptive to a missionary's message for other reasons. Again, narcissistic or hysterical personalities who enjoy the attention that the missionaries give them, borderline personalities who are intolerant of being alone, nearly psychotic people who definitely need some organizing factor to overcome fragmentation and dysphoria, dependent personalities or misfits who simply find that finally here are some people who will accept them. If any of you have been in a family with a schizophrenic member, you know what a terribly draining and destabilizing effect that has on the family. And when the missionaries go out and baptize someone of that sort, that has the same kind of terribly draining and destabilizing effect on a new branch or ward. Maybe I would rather, or maybe the ward would rather have me teach only the well-educated, the talented, the economically stable, who could add to the well-being of the branch or the ward and not be an albatross around their collective necks. But the danger there, of course, is to be an elitist church and an exclusive one, such as portrayed in the picture book, The Story of the Mormons, which we thought when we received it was going to give us all instant credibility by portraying bright-eyed, freshly scrubbed, well-fed, neatly dressed, happy people all walking to church in their neighborhood in unison. We had no such church or ward house in my mission at that time. So in answering the question, then, to whom should we proclaim the gospel, I think maybe we need to consider the people who Christ taught, who certainly didn't seem to fit the same category as those in the picture book. Well, the truth is, we taught whoever we could get to listen to us. If we could get anyone at all, that was considered a successful day. And we tried various innovative ways, innovative meaning other than tracting, street meetings, speaking at funerals, lectures, things about America. Once I spent a long time writing personal letters to anonymous people, and then we would pray and then point our finger in the phone book and see who we should send them to. And inevitably, we would get the letters sent and postcards back saying, visit has no purpose, please don't come. Once our mission president asked Brother Busche, who at that time was his first counselor before he became a general authority, what the German people really needed to be receptive. And he explained the German disillusionment at the church-state corruption that had gone on for a long, long time, and also their feelings about the war and how their families and their lives had been devastated. And he said what they really needed was a return to thinking about religion as a positive force in their life. So we started a campaign, and we had some very professionally done and designed placards with pictures of various churches and the inscription, Warum gehen Sie nicht an diesem Sonntag mit Ihrer Familie in Ihrer Kirche, which means, why don't you go with your own family in your church this Sunday? And we distributed those everywhere we went, to businesses and stores and shops of various kinds, just to put them before all the people of Westphalia to get them thinking about the role that religion ought to play in their lives. And, of course, if they didn't want to go back to their church, there was a prominent picture of the Mormon church. Although, again, we didn't have one that looked anywhere near that nice. And in distributing all of these, two elders were jailed. And I don't know what the charges were, but that's where they ended up. And, you know, we sort of envied them in a way because we would kind of like to be martyred just enough not to hurt ourselves. And so the next placard that came out was much bigger, and we got free advertising space and plastered that all around Westphalia that said, "Practice tolerance and brotherly love." Well, I think of this as a forerunner of the church media campaign, "If you love them, tell them." Which you have seen on television, heard on the radio numerous times. Nowadays, a TV spot would be so infinitely more visible and impactful, and costly, of course. But if I were going on a mission again, maybe what I would really want to take is a communications expert with me to teach me how to reach far more people than I ever would in tracting. I can imagine a clever ad with an 800 number, not a 900 number, with an operator at the other end getting names and addresses and then dispatching missionaries with beepers out to see these people, something like a Domino's pizza man. Interestingly enough, in thinking about how hard it was to try to find somebody to teach, I recently heard from one of my district leaders whose son is now in Czechoslovakia and wrote back a couple of weeks ago, "We have never once been turned down by someone we wanted to talk to." And I can't conceive of that kind of thing happening. Well, once this same district leader came to town, he asked us, "Wouldn't we like to be a part of something big?" And yes, indeed, we would. And he made a proposal that we think about how we could do that. And because all of the older people were set in their ways, maybe we could focus on the younger people. And so we did. And we thought of ways that we could reach the younger people. I happened to bring my banjo with me on the mission. Somebody else had a guitar. So we sat around and started singing some songs. Folk songs were in those days. And a little Kingston trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and that sort of thing seemed to interest some Germans. So we looked around to see where some young people were, and they were out on the sleigh riding hill. So we all took off for the sleigh riding hill and stood around there singing songs. And everybody looked at us and thought that was really weird, but a few people gave us their names. And so we invited them to a lecture on America. And we invited about a dozen, and two showed up, and we figured that wasn't the way to do it, but we were undaunted, and maybe we had to be a little more professional. So we all bought jackets that looked alike and practiced a little bit and thought up a name. We thought we'd call ourselves something that they could associate with the Mormon Church, and so we called ourselves the Temple Squares and went to a school to see if maybe we could meet some young people there. And we got the school authorities to give us permission to sing in the hallway to them in between classes. And we did, and there was a big crowd around, and they liked the songs, and they even laughed at the jokes, though they didn't understand them, but they didn't want their neighbor not to know they didn't understand English nuances well enough not to laugh. And so we decorated the meeting hall something like a high school dance, and expected maybe a couple of dozen people to come. And 250 people came that night, and it was the most amazing thing we had ever seen. And they all had a grand time, and they smoked in the chapel in spite of our Nichtrauchen signs and all that kind of stuff. But it was great, and we got lots of names, and we went back the next week and invited them all again, and we did the same kind of thing for several weeks in a row and got all kinds of people to teach. And we got so good at this that we petitioned the mission president and asked if we couldn't travel the whole mission with our singing group and put on these parties to get all kinds of people for these missionaries to teach. And he said, well, in his thoughtful way, maybe you had better stay and see what you can do in Bielefeld first. And so we did. And out of it finally came two baptisms. And the next mission president was persuaded to have such a group go around. And out of that came two excommunications of two of the missionaries in the group. And so we kind of broke even. But so much for meeting people. The second function, of course, is proclaiming or perfecting the saints. And there are a lot of ways that I can think of protecting or perfecting the missionary saints. In this case, perfecting the saints we were teaching is what I was interested in. And if I were to go on a mission again, I would spend a lot more focus, not so much on proclaiming the gospel, but on perfecting the saints who were already there, already baptized, soon to be, and maybe perfecting the people in whatever country I was in. A number of ways that I can think of to do that, and my time is just about up, so I'm not going to go into them in any detail except to mention that what I would do is resurrect Theodore Burton and take him with me. Theodore Burton gave us a marvelous lecture once. He asked everybody in this big mission conference, why is it that we teach the six lessons? This was a famous six-lesson plan that had just been instituted, and the bright-eyed, freshly scrubbed missionaries who had all the right answers raised their hand and said, because they're inspired of the Lord and they come to us from the prophet, and that's why we should do it. And he looked at them smiling and said, no. He says, we use that because we don't have anything better at the moment. And then he proceeded to give us a lesson on the place of doubt. And at our testimony meeting, he said, I've heard a lot of you elders say you know beyond the shadow of a doubt the church is true, and I'm here to tell you that you don't. I'm here to tell you that you can have a firm conviction and you can have faith, but you don't know that beyond the shadow of a doubt, and there isn't much you do know beyond the shadow of a doubt. And then he proceeded to explain to us how doubt can be a motivating factor in building our faith, and it was wonderful. And I would teach people things like that. Finally, the third prong of the mission of the church, genealogy. I think maybe if I were to go on a mission again, I would go on a genealogy mission. And I'm taking my cue here from my brother-in-law. I have very little interest in the dead, but I have interest in certain dead. He submitted the name of my favorite poet, Gerard Manley Hopkins, to go through the temple. He tried T.S. Eliot, but his widow is still alive, and they wouldn't accept him yet. I would go through for Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, and several others, and invite you all to pick your favorite character from the past and come to the temple with me. Finally, in closing, thinking of a statement from Joseph Campbell when he was interviewed with Bill Moyers. Most of you may remember him, the great mythologist. He says, preachers err in trying to convert other people to their religious ideas by preaching dogma. What they need to be doing is to radiate their own discovery. And that's what I would do if I were to go again. Thank you.
Amen. Having been conditioned by Swiss stubbornness, I must stiff-neckedly confess that I would probably not live my two missions any differently. Note the aw shucks folks plural of my missions. Had I the chance to repeat them. Instead, I would be different, informed by a clearer vision, enhanced by hindsight, bolstered by experience, and anchored in insufferable and self-condemning self-righteousness. Thus, for me, another go-round would inevitably be different and probably disappointing, for distance lends enchantment to the view, and the harsh everyday reality of a mission untouched by the mellowing airbrush of selective memory and intervening, gentling years would be shattering to my spirit. I have served two missions for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The first, a 30-month mission from July 1956 to January 1959, in the Swiss-Austrian mission under the late, great President Jesse R. Curtis. The second, a 36-month mission with my wife Janice Alger Craycroft from July 1986 to July 1989. Presiding over some 400 missionaries assigned to the Switzerland Zurich mission and trying to achieve for them and with them, in my own faltering way, what President Curtis had achieved with his 400 charges exactly 30 years earlier. Thus, I've spent nearly six of my 55 years as a missionary preaching the Restoration in the German language to the peoples of southern Germany, upper and western Austria, and all of German Switzerland. And putting the grainy hot mustard on the wurst, I have been serving over the past year while being processed for translation, something which seems to have been held up in correlation, a modified mission as president of the MTC 13th branch, a position which approximates somewhat the role of mission president, keeps me up to my halo in missionaries and missionary work, and buys the translation office much needed time, struggling as they are with the sampler hanging in my office, which reads, use me, O Lord, in thy work, especially in an executive capacity. Our European area president, Elder Carlos E. Acey, on releasing us from mission presidency on June 28, 1989, asked virtually the same question put to this panel. What would you do differently, President and Sister Craycroft, now that it's all over? Upon consideration, I replied with Janice's assenting nod, without which I have learned to do or say nothing of importance. Although I know there are things which you would have liked me to have done differently, I must say that given my spiritual makeup and my experience as a church leader, I would, appropriate blush and large gulp, probably go back and do the same things over again. You see, somehow I think whatever and however we did it, it worked. And worked for us and for our missionaries. What could the area presidency say to that? With strange smiles of relief, they mumbled, "You're out of here," and we were. I've often pondered what worked for me in what I have always considered a classic mission experience as a young man of 20, which was the standard age in those days. Though I was a deep believer in Mormonism, I had, like several hundred thousand young men before and since, repented my way into the mission field. And I was uncertain as to what I was getting into, but I had somehow come to see a mission as a sentence as of 2 1/2 besuited and behatted years of serving time in a distant junior Sunday school. This negative expectation fell almost immediately before missionary reality. Jolted as I was into spiritual awareness by the grace of God and by a fine senior companion, Elder Gary O'Brien, my mission became a surprising unfolding of my spiritual self, and 30 months was long enough to change forever my habits of thought and my course of life. By 22 1/2, I had experienced, amidst the modest physical handicaps and routines of daily life in small-town Austria and Switzerland, miraculous healings, visions, dreams, revelations, insights, discernings, and steadily miracles of change in myself, and perhaps more importantly, in many men and women who were the joy of fruitful labors attended by the Spirit. The baptism of, for Europe, a goodly number of men and women, the opening of 2 cities to the work for the first time, the establishment of a branch in one of them, and the almost miraculous strengthening and firming of a branch of the church over which I presided for nearly a year. All of this as a young man, counseling couples on marital, financial, sexual, familial problems, and calling and training some 100 fledgling Mormons to conduct the affairs of the church in the Baden, Switzerland branch. I worked hard and I studied hard. I wrote religious poetry. I kept the rules. I paced myself. I seldom missed a week at the keynote. And I learned for the first time in my life that sustained effort seems to gather to it a momentum towards success. As I read in my 2 volumes of journals, I'm reminded that my mission was not without problems and challenges, but I'm also pressed to conclude that certainly mine was a textbook kind of mission. I'm confident then that I wouldn't change a thing, for even the hardships and hard times deepened and enriched and blessed. Look at, for example, at a couple of typical entries in my journal, which suggest what was happening to that young man. On Tuesday, July 17th, 1956, my first day in the field, I wrote, "Got up late. Elder O'Brien let me sleep in until 7 a.m. I had arrived at 2 a.m. Went downtown and bought a new bike for about $65. Then went visiting several cottage meetings. I could understand one, but not all. I don't put here that the very first door we knocked on, the lady was later baptized. She and her family are still stalwarts in the branch there. My first morning, first door speech, we got in and baptized the couple. I didn't know that when I wrote this journal, of course. I could understand some, but not all. Ate at Sister Johnson's house, and then Elder O'Brien dragged me to 2 other places to eat, and unwilling as he was to turn down dinner appointments. Bed, 11 o'clock, we pray together, and then we have personal prayers. I'm blue." Now, note the change in this entry, just 6 months later, from this kid who was blue. Thursday, March 28, 1957. A really rainy day. We had a rather poor day. It tracked all morning and most of the afternoon. 4th tracting, that is. I really pinned the Gross family down. I don't think they'll make it. I had the biggest thrill of my mission tonight. After feeling the inspiration of the Lord, I gave the Staudinger family the plan of salvation lesson and asked if they would like to be baptized. "We will baptize the daughter Margarita on the 28th of April. She said she knows it is true, and she does. I'm so happy. The Lord has made me, old Dick, a tool for bringing the gospel to some wonderful people. I am very happy. The Lord is always giving me inspiration. Hallelujah." Something's happened to that young missionary. That young woman became my first fruit. She became the first member of the little dependent Steyr, Austria branch. In 11 months together, between December 56 and October 57, Elder Walt Williamson and I, with the Lord in tow, baptized some 15 souls, including the head of the Seventh-day Adventist churches of the state of Upper Austria. and founded a branch which continues strong today, despite a history of internal problems so prevalent in the small branches of the church. When Janice and I were there last, I discovered the congregation meets on one level of an apartment building in Steyr, the very building, if memory serves, in which I was attacked and beaten by an irate non-believer who thought my companion had insulted me, but reached me for him, but reached me first. I was assisted in regaining my composure that day by another tenant, a woman who, having observed the incident, was embarrassed by her countryman's actions and promptly invited Elder Williamson and me to dinner and to share our message and to become very good friends of the church. Sister Stouting, the girl I baptized in April of 57, is a librarian at the University of Stuttgart, wife of Bishop Förster, immediate past bishop of one of the Stuttgart wards, mother of three children who have served missions and been married in the Swiss temple. She loves the Lord and His church and can still recite in copious detail, and this refers to something you're saying, the answers to the 25 questions per week about the Doctrine and Covenants, which I assigned her to write up in longhand in our weekly non-member training session with her, which we held for nearly a year after her baptism. She has told me, full of emotion, what our coming meant to her. I have told her, full of emotion, what I learned from her and from that mission. To recognize the pattern of the Spirit in my life, to understand the Lord's patterns of conversion, which I repeated thereafter with little variation, time and again, with everyone whom I taught the next 2 years. And 30 years later, I tried with varying success to teach these same patterns to the 400 missionaries whom I shepherded as mission president. I grew to spiritual manhood in those years, like other missionaries, I'm sure. And I credited it all at the time to President Jesse Curtis, who had, after all, kept pointing me in the direction he wanted me to go and patted me on the fanny from time to time, performing as I would later perform, much like the big league baseball coach, who, when asked what he said to his star hitter when he went up to bat, replied, "I just say, out of way to go, boy, out of way to go." I realize now that a loving mission president is a father figure, a mentor, an attaway-to-go boy speaker who is integral to the most perfect missionary system, the almost perfect missionary system, which is, after all, a microcosm of the plan of salvation. This week I received a tender letter from one of the finest of our Swiss missionaries, recounting a long conversation in the middle of the night which he had recently held with another of Zurich's finest. This elder writes, "We talked about the influence you had on us and this entire mission. I feel very blessed to have had a mission president who could understand me and bring out the best in me. I appreciate the sincere effort you put into your calling as our president. I am especially thankful for your individual approach. I could appreciate how you used your talents to serve the Lord. As I examine my life today, I feel positive about the direction it is pointing. I owe much of what I am to you. Thank you for your faith in me as a missionary. I think that is an important way to inspire others." Well, it happened to him, just as it had happened to me. I'd like to leave the letter at that and bask immodestly in its warm compliments, but I can't. This letter is a tribute not to Dick Craycroft, but to the missionary program of the Church of Christ, and is, as such, could have been written to any mission president by any elder or sister who has served well, has kept the faith. It demonstrates the remarkable shaping and refining power of the missionary system. And it happens again and again, year in, year out, and will continue to recur until the Savior says, "Put out the light." The system works well because the plan of God works. Has always worked and will always work, as the 500,000 plus LDS missionaries of the last dispensation plod and stumble or stride through the divinely inspired rite of passage known as going on my mission. Young men and women respond to their own hearts, the prodding of their parents, the threats of girl or boyfriends, and other pressures. They climb out of their self-centered adolescent ruts and sally forth in the name of God, which they evoke timorously, to bring a sketchily understood but nonetheless clear map of the way home to people they don't know in places whose names they have not heard of in a language they may or may not have played with for one term in high school. And these same weak-kneed youngsters return home shouting praises like the 70 of old at what they have wrought in the name of Jesus Christ. The system works. A mission is the boot camp for would-be saints, the initiation into the holy of holies of the self. It's the second mile on the way to perfection. And what I would do differently on another mission is to help fellow missionaries see the mission as a miniature replica of their lives, to understand that missions like life are intensive kinds of confrontations with oneself, a confrontation in which an individual mission president or missionary struggles to find equipoise, struggles to find a balance between apparently contradictory extremes, polarities. Consider, for example, a number of the paradoxes which every missionary must cope with on the way to finding his or her spiritual equipoise. A missionary is counseled to lose oneself, yet paradoxically to find oneself amidst the losing. This is hard. He is counseled to find, teach, and baptize many souls, like Alma and Amulek and the sons of Mosiah or Wilford Woodruff, yet be at peace when after much labor the harvest is scant and the baptismal whites hang dry in the closet. He is expected to expect momentarily miracles, yet be comfortable with dailiness, be at peace with the plodding mundane and the lack of miracles. He is expected to love God and Christ fully and seek in them one's daily life, yet shun disappointment, anger, or bitterness when after all they seem absent or at least remote. He is counseled to live every mission rule, every commandment of God and man, yet be resilient, not broken or debilitated if guilty of breaking one of those rules or laws. In other words, to forgive himself quickly and freely on one hand, and yet not so quickly as to obviate the necessary teaching, course-altering pain and suffering which accompany such transgression. I had a number of other here, another what we would call the contradictory extremes or polarity. It seems to me that we reach in our missions over and over. We hear in interviews and such these great contradictions and polarities in which the missionaries are struggling with to resolve. And we, as leaders, have to learn to deal with those as well, to learn to frown with a smiling face, to rule with a gloved gauntlet, to judge with the swiftness of a turtle. And these imbalances and incongruities cause frustration. And I go on to say, in brilliant prose, of course, that you'll never hear, how we might be able to resolve these incongruities as missionaries. And I think this is what I would teach these missionaries, is to grope towards a sure foundation in practicing Christ, in venturing faith, in testing the Lord to go out to find if he will, in fact, answer the prayers, and if he will grant them the succor they seek in faith, in their spiritual daintiness, to establish spiritual equipoise, and to, in the midst of all, to get that view of eternity, that eternal perspective that Abraham speaks of when he says, eternity was our covering and our rock and our salvation as we journeyed to Haran. Well, I think that I would urge my missionaries again, and urge myself as a missionary to do as Reinhold Messner did, the great mountain climber, and that is to find and surmount the wall called impossible. And if you can't surmount the wall called impossible, then you have tried, and you have tried valiantly, and you are different because of that, and you have done much to bring together, to resolve the paradoxes which we have. Well, all of this may be a bit high-sounding, but for me it's hard-won insight, and it's what I would do were I to do it again. And I'm afraid that I won't get translated correctly until I do. Thank you.
A story that a friend of mine, Gerald Davis, tells about Richard Craycroft. Gerald was his associate dean in the College of Humanities. Explains to me why he's having so much trouble getting translated correctly. Evidently, Richard was in the Sky Room of the Wilkinson Center at BYU. The waitress comes up and says, "What would you like to drink?" He asks, "Do you have caffeine-free Coke?" And she says, of course. And he says, bring me one of those and two no-dos.
It happened.
If the question stands as it is, how I would live my mission differently, my answer would be, as myself, a 19 and 20-year-old boy, fresh from the splendors of Farmington, New Mexico, and the rigors of a freshman year at BYU, I would live my mission exactly as I did. I would leave for Germany remembering what Marion Hanks said as he set me apart. That's a hard, difficult mission, and I would like a son of mine to go on a mission like that. I would stand in awe at the huge cities and rivers and heavy industry of Germany's Ruhrgebiet. I would be proud of the air that was so filthy that I could wear blue shirts instead of white ones. I would work hard tracting. I would struggle virtuously and with boyish humor to love the people who were rejecting me. I would feel guilty for not rising at 6 a.m. every morning and would dutifully write 7 or 7:30 or 8 a.m. on my reports. I would read Bertolt Brecht and Martin Buber along with the Bible and the Book of Mormon, and I wouldn't feel any more guilty now than I did then. I would, as the mission president encouraged, go to operas, plays, and art museums. And yet one night I would still throw away tickets to see a performance of Goethe's Iphigenia because a young ward member needed companionship on the way home. I would again rejoice with the one woman whose life changed because of the message I brought to her door. I would still be thankful for lessons of love, humility, charity, faith, and companionship that my mission confronted me with. And most important for what I want to say today, I would again stand in front of the America House in Cologne, watching thousands of politically concerned students demonstrate against America's war in Vietnam, and I would again feel a solidarity with them, not because I was against the war, for Hartman Rector was our visiting general authority, and I knew that our country was good and proper and right, even in times of war. But I would sympathize with them because I saw myself as a revolutionary. In fact, I tried to argue that in a good many discussions with students during that long summer. Stephen Epperson's poem, Tangled Woods and Parisian Light, published in the April 1991 Sunstone, captures that idea of missionary as revolutionary better than anything I've read. The scene is a Parisian street during a violent, destructive student revolution. Quote, the hierophants burst into the narrow street, casting cars aside, flourishing banners. Flames leapt from the flanks of the procession, casting a perihelion of light. Voices rose to glossolalian heights, unquote. These young people are powerful because of their certitude, their knowledge of how the world should be ordered. They are, quote, the disciples of hieratic history, the masters of dialectic, the architects of humanity, unquote. They have strength because of, quote, the simplicity of the shouted syllogisms, the utter directness of the violence, the thrill of the extraordinary gesture, unquote. In the meantime, two missionaries sit under a portal and teach a man and his boy. Quote, the tale of a youth and the questions he bore into a tangled wood. The tale neared its end, quote, the wood shone, the boy returned through the fields, a live ember of divine words in his hand, and thus his story began, unquote. Like the revolutionary students, these two French missionaries have a utopian vision. Quote, could the earth be changed in a day? Could a man, unquote. The missionaries are architects of the soul, building peacefully while the students celebrate an orgy of violence and destruction. Stephen's images are wonderful ones, privileging the revolutionary power of quiet words and a still, small voice over the destruction of earthquakes and fire. He has a poet's vision of Zion and the words to give it form. From his poem and from my memories of and feelings of solidarity with the demonstrating students in Cologne comes the question I would rather ask today. Not how would I live my mission differently, but just how revolutionary are our missionaries today? We know all the stories of the 19th century missionaries and their legendary successes. We also know some of the reasons why whole congregations followed these men into the water to be baptized. Tens of thousands of English and Danes and Norwegians and others joined the church because Mormons brought a revolutionary message to them.
oppressed by state churches, and impoverished and alienated by the Industrial Revolution, these men and women recognized the voice of God in a call to Zion. They would help build the city of God, become fellow citizens with the saints. They would join a society experimenting with a radical economic system, one they recognized as the antithesis of the capitalism that had impoverished them. But most importantly, they would take part in a revolution that would change their lives and the world they lived in. As I look back on my mission, I have the vague feeling that my message was not nearly as revolutionary as the 19th century visions my fellow missionaries spread. The unease I feel centers on a Christmas memory. Wuppertal was the city. My companion and I visited a sick boy, about 11 years old, and found that he was in the hospital suffering from malnutrition. His father had fallen off of a wall at work and broken his back, and was still in the hospital after several months. The next morning, we went out to visit the family, wondering if the boy was suffering from malnutrition, just how was the family living. We took a streetcar, then the hanging railroad there, and then finally a bus clear out into the country. There was snow on the ground, and the wind was blowing, and as we finally found the place we thought it was, we found that it was a farmhouse that was all boarded up, and a concrete block building right next to it, a one-room building, was where the family was living. We went in, and the woman was so depressed and maybe hungry that she couldn't even speak. And the young children were huddled in a blanket, half-clothed. There was no heat in the room, and there was trash and garbage all over the place, and obviously no food in the room. We didn't know what to do. We were used to being fed by members, not feeding them. We hadn't brought anything with us. We asked if we could help clean up the room, but she wasn't speaking, and so we didn't know whether she wanted us to or not. So we cleaned up the room. We found some wood outside and lit a fire in the stove, but we weren't sure if that was right either. Maybe she'd been saving that wood for an even colder time. There wasn't much of it. After about an hour, we were just uncomfortable. We were a little happy because she'd started speaking, but we didn't know what to do. And then there was a knock on the door, and it was the local Catholic priest, and he'd brought a great big box of food for them. And he told them Merry Christmas, and he left this big box of food, and out he went. And we left soon after that, too. And here's my real regret, the thing I'm remembering, and that's that we didn't ever go back. We may have said something to the branch president, I don't remember, but I personally never did anything more for that family. I spent the next day calling lawyers and dentists on the phone, asking if they would like a free copy of the Book of Mormon. I spent a warm Christmas with an investigator family. I did a lot of tracting in the next weeks, but I never went back. I didn't have anything to give this family except for the 6 missionary lessons I had memorized. Nearly 20 years later, I served a second mission of sorts, this time as a counselor in the Franklin, Tennessee Stake Mission Presidency. The year was 1987, and again I have regrets, for I let myself be used in a wasteful, shallow, and ultimately fruitless venture. The plan, as visiting general authorities explained to us, was to offer a free cassette tape to the citizens of Nashville, a wonderfully, professionally done tape that would change their lives. The church would buy enough airtime on TV so that normal watchers of TV would see the ad offering the tape 7 times. 20 to 30 extra missionaries would be brought into Nashville, and members would team with them to double the numbers. TV watchers would dial a toll-free number, order the tape, we would deliver it to them, and soon, with the help of the beautiful videotape we would bring into their homes, missionaries would be teaching thousands of people. Time came, the church did its part, the ad was everywhere on TV, including a 30-second slot during the World Series, which must have cost them $500,000. Attractive young actresses and actors in a beautiful setting, bearing sincere testimony that this cassette tape had changed their lives, and wouldn't the viewers please order one for themselves? As a matter of fact, a lot of cassettes were ordered. We delivered them as rapidly as possible. But in the end, there were very few lessons taught, and only a single baptism resulted. And my question is why? If you've seen or heard the tape, Our Heavenly Father's Plan, you may have an inkling. What was the revolutionary message of the tape, supposedly comparable to the glorious and concrete vision of Zion preached in the 19th century? A handsome, young, stylishly dressed actor with a new truck and horses, while professing that he and his viewers are children of God and can talk to him as a friend, really teaches the lesson taught just as well at any mall of straight teeth, well-cut hair, brand-name clothing. Accompanying his sincerely acted testimony is the mall music so appropriate to the rest. I've got to find out who I am, and when I do, I know I'll do what I can. When I find out who I am, I'll be all I can. A female pop singer asks if God will answer her prayers. Will he answer me? Will he see what my heart needs? Will he have the time for me? Will he really answer me? And a male pop singer has the reassuring answer. Naturally, the woman questions and the man knows the truth. He's never broken his promise. He'll be there. He hears each word and heartfelt prayer. He's devoted to you. He'll help you know what is true. That's what he's promised to do. This music underscores the masculine authority that other images of the film teach. There's one view, a baby has just been born. And as the mother in kind of a mottled blue and white hospital gown sinks into the background, a father in brilliant temple white holds a baby in a brilliant white blanket. And you know who's in charge here and who's good. Let's see. So the music underscores that masculine authority. And in between the music, the actor uses salesman words like honest, sincere. I don't want to talk you into something, just share something with you. I hope you can experience that for yourself. I really do. What is the vision of this immensely expensive missionary? Message of the 80s. I'm okay. You're okay. It's the message crafted in response to what the pollsters have found out. What do people really want today? To feel warm and good inside. And what's the result of such pandering? Let me quote a recent French visitor to Salt Lake who got the visitor center's message. Salt Lake City. Pompous Mormon symmetry. Everywhere marble. Flawless. Funereal. Yet a Los Angeles modernity, too. All the requisite gadgetry for a minimalist extraterrestrial comfort. The Christ-topped dome. All the Christs here are copied from Thorvaldsen's and look like Bjorn Borg. Straight out of Close Encounters. Religion as special effects. In fact, the whole city has the transparency and supernatural, otherworldly cleanliness of a thing from outer space. A symmetrical, luminous, overpowering abstraction. Jean Baudrillard's description, while missing all that feeds and sustains us as fellow saints, is a warning to us. What direction are we headed? Toward abstraction. Where then are the visionary metaphors that will revolutionize the world? I want to close by again quoting Stephen Epperson, a piece published in Dialogue in 1987, especially meaningful to me today because 3 weeks ago my brother John died alone in a flop house, alcoholic, of AIDS, in dire need of more than abstractions. Stephen writes of inner cities like the one where my brother lived, where our brothers and sisters live. So much blight, so much toughness. We abandon the cities again and again to the paradigms of Babylon, Sodom, Gomorrah. Abandon them to the Catholic Church and the AME churches, the Bethel Baptist churches, the Holy Spirit Alliance Tabernacle of Prayer. But now the times of the Gentiles and the suburbs is passing, and the church seeks new fields for its husbandry. Will we find God in these cities? What Latter-day Saint will find the interpretive, ministrational key and gift to liberate these captives for God's kingdom? What new paradigm, what vision alternative do we have?
I will go ahead and introduce myself. My name is Bonnie Lynn Mitchell. I'm a fifth or sixth generation Mormon. I have 3 degrees from BYU. While I was at BYU, I managed to become a feminist and a moderate Democrat. Quite a feat in those days. I served a mission in southern Chile, Chile Concepcion. I'm a single mother. I have a 10-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son. After my degrees at BYU, I worked for 3 years for the Utah Navajo Development Council, then for 4 years as director of the Multicultural Center at Southern Utah State College, now Southern Utah University. I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of Texas at Austin. And I will be teaching full-time at Weber State this fall and at BYU in the winter. And I wrote these sort of off the top of my head, and I will just read them that way. I stayed until the very sweet end with Eloise Bell last night and then was on the first two sessions this morning, so it's been kind of long. What I would do differently if I could do my mission over again. I would make wiser choices about the battles I fought. I would have a better idea of what I was up against. I would spend more time taking care of myself, even pampering myself from time to time, and not feel guilty about it. I would get more sleep. I would remember that scripture about it not being needful to run faster than one has strength. I wouldn't worry so much about following the schedule or even trying to approximate the schedule set for the elders. Why, I think a missionary committee concerned about keeping young men very busy so they will stay out of trouble. I would practice speaking with power and authority in ward settings. I came out of the BYU Honors Program, which was a very supportive environment, and I didn't realize that the church structure differed substantially from the Honors Program and that I would have difficulty being heard. I would practice, this is questionable, I'm not sure about this one, I wrote, I would practice interrupting and getting the floor that way instead of waiting for my turn and speaking softly, although I'm not sure I want to imitate the men in this. I would realize that a mission is likely to be a more stressful experience for a young woman than a young man, and I would go with more stress reduction, relaxation, and meditation techniques in place, in practice in my daily life. In essence, I would value myself and the gifts and talents I have more, and I would protect myself. Not from Satan so much, or from the diseases in the country where I served or where others serve, or the lack of sanitation, or superstitious traditions, or any other such perceived plagues of the land wherever I might be called to serve. I would protect myself from the subtle but very destructive effects of trying to live as a female within a male system. I take basic issue with the system works well, doesn't work very well for many who are female. I believe the basic feminist tenet that naming the problem is the first step toward being able to deal with it. I name the problem patriarchy for women trying to serve missions. And I don't blame the individual men involved. It's not bad intentions of men in positions of authority, but systemic constraints, rules, perceptions, things we take for granted, the questions we don't ask. Patriarchy, by its very nature, ignores and/or trivializes the gifts and talents and training and experience of women. Women are not heard. They have no voice. Worse, women in the system, women raised in the system, don't realize they have anything important particularly to say. They can't name patriarchy as the problem, and they often have trouble articulating what the major obstacles that they face are within the church on a daily or weekly basis. So I'd probably be a little bit more vocal about the constraints, the unnecessary stresses, the injustices, the absurdity bordering on cruel and unusual punishment embodied in mission rules indiscriminately applied to women. I'd claim my power. I'd recognize the limits of my power. I'd know that the problem is not inside me as much as endemic to the system. Here I digress. A common perception, I think, among many missionaries is that lady missionaries are flunkies in the marriage market and are out there because they couldn't snag a man. In my case, there was a very intelligent and very sincere man who wanted to marry me, and I had been in the Washington Seminary in Washington, in D.C., and prayed very fervently about what I was supposed to do and came to the conclusion that I was supposed to serve a mission. This was not an easy decision for me. His parents were also not very happy. My main question is what to do as a woman with many gifts and talents within a system that is blind to one's abilities and possibilities. First, recognize that the main problem is structural, not individual women's faults. I think it is our tendency as believing, struggling persons, and it was so in my case, to automatically assume that if we are out of harmony with any aspect of the Lord's church, that something must be wrong with us, in my case, something wrong with me. This is not always the case. In many instances, I believe it is not the Lord's doing. In fact, I think he would wish it otherwise, but rather that he tolerates imperfect men to run his organization during this period in time, perhaps because they have not yet had the courage to ask if it should be otherwise. The Lord would not want to see the gifts and talents of faithful women going to waste, as they often do in the mission field and at home. While I believe motherhood is very important, I do not believe that the person I think of as divine and female limits herself to childbearing activities. Nor can I, at least not without going crazy. In our sometimes naive faith, and I'm speaking of myself, we as women may think, these good men are called of the Lord, and they wouldn't do anything to hurt me. No, not intentionally. But for me, that's just the point. The things which are most hurtful are the taken-for-granted assumptions about what are appropriate activities for women, assumptions that force us to be less than what we are. So well-intentioned mission presidents often do great psychological damage to talented women because they don't think of asking the Lord about their underlying premises. For instance, they don't think of asking women for advice. They don't consider that women may have insights unavailable to men, which if expressed could do much to further the cause of Zion. Now I'm speaking from personal experience here, and I recognize that many mission presidents may be more solicitous of the women's views over whom they supervise. It is appropriate for women to seek all of the gifts of the Spirit, not just get into our stereotypical notions of femininity. Women need to learn to speak with power and authority as moved to do so by the Holy Spirit. They need to practice not asking for permission for every little good thing they want to do. They need to reclaim the blessing Joseph Smith pronounced upon women at the Organization of Relief Society. I now turn the key to women. One might ask, if the system is so oppressive, so stressful for women, why choose to work within it? Why not opt out? And I was asked this question by Elbert, saying, you know, many women who are feminist and have been so for a long time would just say, forget it. They wouldn't do it again. I would do it again. I have a twofold answer. First, because I believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet and that the church he established, in spite of its many imperfections, is still the Lord's attempt to build Zion on earth. And secondly, because I firmly believe that the oppression of women cannot continue indefinitely, that the Lord will hear and answer the prayers of the sisters, especially the prayers of the women whom the system has not heeded, whom the system has ignored, trivialized, and condemned. This invisibility problem is common to women, minorities, all sorts of people. The prayers of the sisters will stand as a witness that all was not well in Zion, that the sisters' pain of being invisible was seen and heard above. The last shall be first is a phrase I like to remember. Women will take their rightful places as co-leaders in the kingdom. As President Kimball stated in the conference address, much of the growth of the church will come because of the righteous example of articulate women who can speak on behalf of the church. I guess that's about all I want to say. Now entertain questions, and we'll repeat the questions so that they can be recorded on the tape if anybody have questions. The comment was that much of the success of an individual's mission would be dependent on the mission president and how willing he is to be able to hear and respond to individual needs and use the talents within of the people within his mission. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. And I don't want to leave the impression that my mission was a totally negative experience. And in dealing with the people and on a one-to-one basis, I had some wonderful, marvelous experiences. So it's both. You were next and then back. The question is, how could your mission president have helped you? What would you like to have seen your mission presidents do differently? Well, I hate to tell anybody else what to do. I think that in the comment that was addressed pretty well for me, and that is to listen. And it's not just to give the standard answer and wait for the standard response. I feel heard when somebody shows an interest in me, in what my particular talents and interests and trainings are, and that they value the particular talents that I have. I think if I would have felt that, I would have had a much more positive experience.
Question back
here. Okay.
I had two mission presidents each for about half of the time I was there, and I really had no complaints about either one of them. I thought they were both wonderful, and their styles were very different. The first one was a businessman, and I knew some members who didn't like him at all because he had displaced them in favor of having a missionary run the branch, and that's because he thought the members were being quite obstructionist to growth of the branch. But I thought he did a fine job. I only mentioned really one thing about him, and that was when we all had this singing group and wanted to go on tour, he said no, and he was right. The other experience that comes to my mind immediately with him was that when I was out about 11 months, I could see that the people who were with me were being made senior companions, and I wasn't yet. I was serving as a companion to the missionary who was the branch president, and we did a lot more tending the members' needs at that time than we did proselyting. And instead of making me a senior companion, he sent me off to another small town to work with somebody else. And I wrote him a letter about it, and he wrote back and said, I didn't send you out there just to sit. I sent you out there to learn something. And in fact, he did. And the person that I was with happened to be the grandson of President McKay, and he was a quiet, unassuming, very smart guy who was a marvelous companion and taught me an awful lot in the mere month that I was with him and knew how to make a success of anything he did. And he is now the president of WordPerfect and made a great success of that. And that was a wonderful experience for me to work with him. My other mission president had a very different style. I remember calling him up once in great distress because a couple of the elders in my district, when I was the district leader, just couldn't get along at all and didn't know how to solve their problems. And I called him up and said, what should I do? And he said, you're the district leader. You take care of it. And that was a great experience for me. I thought they served the mission and myself very well.
About 10 years ago, maybe a little longer, Marion Hanks addressed the problem that I was concerned with, and that's of missionaries making a difference in the economic real lives of members. He suggested to the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve that missionaries be asked to spend at least one day a week doing community service or doing service to a person or a family or something of that sort instead of spending all of their time tracting. He was taken out of his missionary position and put into a temple presidency on recommending this with some fervor. But 10 years later, that's the case. Missionaries are now asked to do community service. If I'd had that kind of direction from a mission presidency, I might have had something to give this family that I didn't have anything to give.
May I respond quickly? Although he excluded me from the possibility of expand. Right. But I wanted to say, first to what the lady in the back said, that I think mission presidents do make a remarkable impact and difference. And I think from my first mission president, I asked him once what his secret was, and he said, I go this way and not this way. And that's the way he explained it. And I think that for me, that made all the difference. I note, though, that I would suppose 90% of the missionaries I know from our mission agreed that he was right. It was a minority who said, I didn't like this mission president. And I have found since that no mission president is going to be the best mission president for all. There are all sorts of types. It seems to me mission presidents come down into two groups, the love your fellow men type and the show them how to do it and make them hold their feet to the fire type. And for me, the latter type is repelling. For some missionaries, they think that is the most wonderful kind of thing. I had a mission president who held my feet to the fire. And if they don't get burned, then I think that's fine, although the burning is probably part of it. I I won't comment any further on here.
Yeah. Well, I've had the experience, as I've said, of evaluating a number of people who were supposed to go on missions, supposed to meaning, I guess, that somebody wanted them to or they wanted to themselves and needed to be evaluated first. You know, for a long time, evaluating a missionary before going out was not something that was done as far as mental health was concerned. There was only a physical exam to be passed, and then any amount of goodwill and faithfulness could solve any problem. And my father worked long and hard to convince the general authorities that there ought to be more screening than that. And so now there are some questions about mental health, too. I remember a schizophrenic young man that I said could go out on his mission. He went to the mission training school before he ever got to me, and while there he had an experience that made him feel extremely guilty and sinful, and he went into a catatonic state and wouldn't eat, move, talk, speak, anything, but just sit on a chair and stare for 24 hours approximately. And so he finally got sent down to the hospital, and we worked with him for a long time and got him out of his psychosis. And it took about 9 months before he was stabilized, but he was doing well. We gave him medicines. We stay on these, and you can go out, but not to Sweden. You'll have to go to a place where we know that the medical care is readily available in a language that you can understand. And he went to British Columbia, which is a country in a lot of ways, served a good mission, wrote me letters, had a good experience for his 2 years, came back, and shortly thereafter had another schizophrenic episode. That got resolved, and the whole thing worked very well for him. I don't know if it was chance, luck, the Lord's blessing, or what that made that work, but it did. It may not work. It may have some rather disastrous consequences. For the most part, the worst thing that can happen to a missionary who is not suited to what he's doing is that he'll have to be sent home. And I'm not sure, or she, and I'm not sure that that is such a disastrous consequence. That's kind of an individualized thing, and how he adjusts to the problem and how he responds to treatment is the determining factor. Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I thought you said that he was. Well, that wouldn't be my automatic assumption. I would encourage him to do what he felt best in doing. I would say that he would probably make a better missionary than a good share of others on the basis of further experience than many of them have and better education. But I certainly would not encourage him to go because he was feeling a lot of pressure to do it.
I noticed that missionaries seem to be more comfortable when they move with their in sync with the rest of their peers. Those who had got degrees, received as far as even MA degrees, always were somehow apologetic or felt that they had to explain why they waited. And finally, I think in the long run, it doesn't matter. But the missionary, if he goes with his peers, he's just got out of high school, he might have spent a year at school, or he might have worked for a few months. That's the norm. And when I went, you had 2 years of college before you went. And I think it did make a difference in maturity. But I think with the system the way it is now, I would recommend, all things being equal, that the missionary go with his peer group into the field and not complete. We found that most colleges are willing to hold, contrary to your experience, a scholarship open for a sharp student. And certainly if it's a church school, there's no question about it. I think it's important for them to get out as soon as they can. When they're younger, they're more malleable. Don't let them be too thoughtful when you get them out there. They're going through a lot of experiences, and I think they adjust better and more rapidly to the experience going more when they're younger. Let me just say about sisters that your feeling is just totally foreign to me with lady missionaries. The only problem we ever had was one that he solved, that
We are told very definitely, you will not appoint lady missionaries to any kind of leadership position. You will not have any kind of organization which involves lady missionaries. And I think all of us, most all mission presidents, find some way around that. And we end up appointing a lady missionary group. Most of them don't call it lady missionary, they call them sister missionaries. And we manage to have some kind of supervisory capacity that we assign to the best sisters, and they go around and they have workovers with the lady missionaries, and we have special conferences for them, and we try to treat them specially, and they're always the leaders of the field. You always plant two lady missionaries into a weak district and watch the thing bloom as all the sexual things start to happen, and the elders want to perform for the lady missionaries and get the lady missionaries patting them on the heads. And the lady missionaries, if they're sharp, know how to manipulate them beautifully, and everything works out well. And they get lots of credit and lots of glory. And the lady missionaries we had were very happy, well adjusted, and I'd shoot any one of them for saying what you just said.
Let me just make a real quick comment that I think that's precisely the problem, and that if you have a sister missionary who has some talents and skills that would be appropriate to share with the elders in a leadership position, that structurally that's impossible at this point.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. If I had had the basic course in Western civilization, I think I'd have done a much better job as a missionary. There is a flip side to the idea, though, of getting well-educated and a lot more mature before you go on your mission. You definitely will make a better missionary. But on the other hand, my experience was that after having gone on my mission, I made a much better student.
My comments about reading Martin Buber and Bertolt Brecht were connected with that. My mission had a little black book, and there was a list of books which had the imprimatur. You could only read those books, and there were five of them, I think, and none of them had anything to do with the country or the culture. And I found I couldn't talk with people. I mean, it was like I was, everything I had was good, and they had to accept it, and they didn't have anything, and I wasn't going to talk or listen to them. And what guided me in making that decision to read German things and to find out about it was a memory of going home teaching with my father. And my father was the last person ever to think that stamp collecting would be interesting in any way. But we home taught a person who didn't ever come to church, who had a lot of money and who collected a lot of really interesting stamps. And my father read up for several months on stamp collecting, and then all of a sudden could ask these very interesting questions as we went visiting. And the man was interested then in what my father had to say because my father was interested in what he had to say. And I think a foreign missionary needs that kind of grounding in some way. I don't know how to do it.
I agree. I joined as a young missionary when we did not have a black book book a month club. In about third or fourth month I was out, I read a German. I read Goethe and Schiller, Grillparzer, and a lot of these. Got introduced to German writing and didn't think it was wrong. And I quoted it to my president all the time. I quoted it in my talks, and he thought it was great. And that doesn't happen anymore. Yeah, one of the I found as a mission president that we would try in each of our zone conferences to have a cultural Stunde, where we tried we taught them everything from in München steht ein Hofbräuhaus to great song. And see, that is German culture, whether you Germans realize it or not. But that's not what we taught them, of course. But we tried to give them a sense of the German culture. They did not appreciate it. There was a general non-response, and this is where maybe being older is better. But I felt a lot of the times what we tried to do so hard in teaching them Swiss and Austrian history and background just went right over their heads, and we felt like in that sense we were teaching cultural barbarians. And so we turned with Gerne to teaching München State Einhofbräu. They liked that. They did not like much else about what we taught them about about Swiss or Austrian culture. And that was always a problem to me because I was very big on it, and I thought that's where I'm going to be a strong mission president. But I found that the missionaries were not culturally very prepared or ready for those experiences, to my sorrow. Yeah, and we would mine them so that every missionary could say, "Wenn mancher man wüsste, wer mancher man wäre, gäbe mancher man mancher man manchmal mehr Air," and we would go through and learn have them learn Sprüche and so forth. We would do that. You don't like that, obviously. But what would you have done? Oh, well, we do that, but they don't care. They don't care. That's the problem.
I felt that was one of the most frustrating things in my mission. There were not only lists of what you could read, but what you could listen to. And in my particular mission, we could only listen to the Tabernacle Choir. And when after I came back, I taught at the Missionary Training Center. And one of my degrees from BYU is a master's degree in Latin American Studies. And I've since worked in multicultural environment extensively. And I think there are ways of teaching cultural sensitivity that are other than lecture and other than the ways that are normally used. So I don't see that as the challenge as much as ways of presenting information in ways that people in that age group can assimilate.
We used to ridicule the Catholic Index, which was a list of books that Catholics could not read. But, of course, we had one that was much narrower than theirs. We were told to read nothing but the Scriptures, not even read Jesus the Christ, for example. But I read books about the politics of Germany.
I was going to mention that things like Der Spiegel or things like that were off limits would, you know, if people were interested, newspapers, things about current events, those ought to be permissible. Maybe they are now, I don't know. Yeah, see, and that would, they're forbidden, but they would help missionaries become informed about current events and make door openings easier. You can talk about what's going on and get in that way.